You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to Truthful Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 8th of February 2019, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and we're broadcasting live today at RadioAryan.com because we have the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, Communism by the Back Door, and the Freemasonic Victory of World War II, Mr. Dennis Wise. Dennis, how are you doing today?
Well, I'm doing all right. One of them weeks for you. I've tried to take a week off if I could, because I wanted to restart the next part of the series next week after just recently completing 17 and 18, which were a bit of a mammoth job, but everything seems to have worked out well, and it's still up on YouTube, and it's had some good reports and a good review, shall I say. And I'm looking forward to this next part, which could even be two or three parts before I get through it all.
Yeah, I'm in a pretty good mood tonight as well. I just watched a live stream from Tommy Robinson, and apparently he's had undercover reporters filming Panorama, who've been trying to do an expose on him, and apparently they set him up. Obviously they tried to set up some fake news, some fake scandal, and apparently he's got it all on film and he's going to expose them. He thinks it's a massive expose, and members of Panorama will be sacked, and also Hope Not Hate, or he's got all of them colluding together apparently, and he's going to put it all on a big screen outside the BBC headquarters in Manchester in a couple of weeks' time.
Yeah.
It just sounds really wonderful if it all goes off and it is as good as he says.
The press itself over the years, and I know they have this immunity, because I think the only case that I ever heard was when Liberace took the Daily Mirror to court because he said he was homosexual, and he won, but then he's worth billions, weren't he? You know what I mean? But then when he died, obviously everybody found out he was homosexual.
I think this is the case. I mean, if he's got hidden camera footage, I guess the BBC will be doing all they can to prevent him showing it. But I mean, it would be great just to expose these groups. The BBC, Hope Not Hate, the Daily Mail, all these organisations work together to just create scandals, basically. They lie, they exaggerate, they take things out of context. It's all done basically just to slander their competition. The alternative media is their competition now. I was watching a Molyneux speech at the European Union Parliament building, and he was saying, he's the most popular philosopher that there is in the world. I mean, he's got thousands of people that listen to him. And he was saying that less people watch CBS, less people watch the BBC online. It's the alternative media that really gets people wanting to follow it, because we're telling the truth. And we're their direct competition. So what they're doing is, when they slander us, when they take us out of the search engine results, it's all done so that they can get rid of their competition. And that is really dishonest. That's really dishonest business practices, besides lying about us. So, it'd be fantastic if what Tommy says is true. And we look forward to that in a couple of weeks. But also this week, you sent me a booklet, Dennis. A really interesting booklet. Yeah. Behind the Dictators by L.H. Lehman, written in 1944. And it basically vindicates everything that you've been saying about the Catholic Church and National Socialism.
Exactly. I mean, as a person who sent it, I sent a message back after I completed it, and I actually said, you don't know the feeling that this actually gives me, because everything that I've said, which I knew to be true, in this PDF has confirmed everything. And there's one happy guy going to sleep tonight.
Yeah, well, there's lots of quotes there, quotes from popes, quotes from bishops. And the guy himself was basically setting out to slander the Catholic Church. I mean, he was coming at it from a hostile view. So this isn't somebody that's trying to say, oh, the National Socialists are Christian because we're Christian. He's a Protestant who is trying to say that fascism was Catholic. And this is what we've been saying for a long time, is that Catholicism had a big influence on fascism. And in this booklet proves it. So what we've got tonight, we've got some quotes from quotes from it that we can go into. Just before we get into that, I mean, I did a little bit of digging around, and the author, this L.H. Lehman, the name itself could be Jewish. It might not be. It's basically it's a German name, but looking at the biographies of him, they all say he was born in Ireland, and they don't go back any further than that. And mm-hmm. I think that, you know, that's a little bit suspicious because they don't say what his father did, and normally they would have done. So I'm thinking he probably was a Jew, and he was probably
trying an awful lot of stuff, by the way.
Yeah, there's another one he did as well, the Vatican, I think, and National Socialism, and he wrote some other stuff about the Jews. And I think one of the Holocaust sites mentions him as well. So it is probable that that he is a Jew, but he's dug up some really, really good information here.
I can't believe it.
Well, it's your lucky day. I mean, I think you've proved it all anyway, Dennis. So it's good to see that there is other information out there that you hadn't yet come across that mm-hmm. proves the same thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Just backs up what you were saying. The first quote that I've got from it is about masonry, and I picked this one because I thought it gives a really good explanation of what it is that's dangerous about Freemasonry. And he says, it makes it clear about the Vatican's fight against it as well. He says the culminating point in the Vatican's fight against Jews and Freemasons is to be found in the encyclicals of Popes Pius IX and Leo XIII. Pius IX styles Masonic lodges as synagogues of Satan and accuses them of having fomented wars and revolutions which put Europe to the fire and the sword. Pope Leo XIII, in his encyclical Humanum Genus, 1884, calls Freemasonry a work of the devil and an impure epidemic. He accuses Freemasonry of aiming to destroy the churches, the state, and the public well-being. He states that among the chief reasons why Freemasons and democracy must be condemned are the following. They teach that all men have the same rights and are perfectly equal in condition, that every man is naturally free, that no one has a right to command others, that it is tyranny to keep men subject to any other authority than that which emanates from themselves. Hence, they hold that the people are sovereign, that those who rule have no authority but by the commission and concession of the people, so that they can be deposed, willing or unwilling, according to the wishes of the people. Thus, the origin of all rights and civil duties is in the people, or in the state, which is ruled according to the new principles of liberty. They hold that the state must not be united to religion, that there is no reason why one religion ought to be preferred to another, and that all must be held in the same esteem. He ends his encyclical by inviting all the Catholic clergy, as well as the whole lay world, to exterminate the Freemasons without mercy. And I think that's really interesting, because that's exactly what we have today. That's the system that we have today. We're told that it's all about human rights, and human rights are given by the state and they come from the people, and all religions are the same, regardless of whether one is true or not. I mean, that's the point. Religion, there can only be one religion because there can only be one truth. And what it's saying here is they're all equal to one another, which is to say that lies have as much weight as the truth. Do you think of this quote here, Dennis, about the main reason why Freemasonry is so wrong?
Well, again, you know, I'm puzzled why this side of Freemasonry has never been, you know, looked in World War II, because Hitler just doesn't destroy them, you know, just for the sake of it. And plus, the other countries as well, in Belgium, all these other countries, what took on Christian leaders, in Slovakia, destroyed all the lodges. And this is the root of this holy war. And it doesn't surprise me, even when he comes out with a brutal term like, they must be exterminated, because it is what it is. You know, it was a battle to the death, unfortunately. You know, they won.
That's the way they talked back then. That is the way that they talked back then. I mean, that's the way that we fought our wars. I mean, you think about the wars between the Saxons and the Britons, they were trying to exterminate one another. If you look back in the historical chronicles, that's the exact terminology that they use. And in the history of the kings of Britain, they exterminated them, and that was it. They got rid of them all. So that was the language that they used. But the interesting bit is, I think as well, this is obviously where Hitler got his views from Freemasonry and Jews from, was from the church. Something that we don't get told today. And it's quite clear there, this warning against Freemasonry and what it does, that's everything that Hitler was fighting against. So that must be where he originally heard about Freemasonry from, would have been from his father and from the priests.
Correct. He was taught by them. Like I said, I mean, he was born a Catholic. He was always talking about, you know, the fascination that he felt when he was in a Catholic church, and the incense, the smell of the incense. He was deeply rooted in, you know, Catholic religion. I mean, he was going to be a priest at one point. And that's not easy just to shift. You know, how these people say that he's a pagan, you know, and I've always contested that, because obviously I learned from a different source about World War II, and they truly believed in the Balkans that he was fighting for the Catholic Church.
Now, someone wants to be a priest, it's not like they don't know anything about it. I mean, he must have studied it, and there must have been a reason why he wanted to be a priest. And I would suggest that he realised that, you know, the church wasn't going to be able to do this, but he could do it with the power of the state. And that's that's why the church backed him. It's because he was carrying out the church's policy. And that is the church's policy on Freemasonry, was exterminate the Freemasons without mercy. And this is the reasons why. This liberty, this everything that we have today that has become human rights, that all comes from Freemasonry. That's the origin of it all.
Yeah, well, it stems from the French Revolution, doesn't it? And this illusion of democracy is really, you know, a way to enslave us from behind the curtain.
The people ruling the people. I mean, it's a nonsense. It's just ruled by the mob. Like we're told today, well, whoever is in the police must be made up of the community it's policing. Well, that's like saying whoever is teaching a class full of school children must be a child themselves. That's not what you want. There's no good in saying the authority must be made up of the subject. Again, it's like saying, well, you know, how can the authority also be the subject? One has to be the subject, the other has to be the authority or the monarch. You can't be both at the same time. And you need people that are trained and that are experts in their fields to be in authority. Not somebody that's just dragged up off the street. I mean, the thing with Hitler was that he'd worked his way through everything. He had actually seen everything, and he had good advisors there. So I guess there is that to say for it. But the system that he was going to put in place, he would have nominated who was going to follow after him. It wasn't going to be the people voting for them. You know, people that vote are possibly the least qualified people to decide who should be in power. I mean, think about it.
Well, when they're actually voting for them, I don't believe they are choosing. Usually the person has been chosen. It's just an illusion that you go to the voting booth and I suppose it's a bit of theatre, and then, you know, a bit of cliffhanging on the TV at night. And then, you know, earlier in the morning we have a leader, but I think that leader's been chosen long before.
Yeah, and also because most of the people don't actually understand what's going on. If you take it today, people just watch the television, they're told who to vote for, and it's only about 1% of the people that actually follow what's going on in the world and understand the way that the system works and are qualified to vote. 99% of them aren't, and it's that 99% that don't really know what's going on. They're the ones that have the final say because they've got the numbers. That's what's so ridiculous about democracy.
Well, if you really think about it, you know, to remove real power is not going to take voting. That's just an obvious fact. I mean, they probably got into power through winning a war, and they ain't going to leave through voting.
Well, he managed to get in place legally through voting, and then that was one of the first things he did was to say, look, we don't need all these parties and all this distraction. We just want people of integrity. And when you think about democracy, I mean, what we've got today is a corrupt democracy. But even if you have a democracy that's fully functioning, it's still going to be decided by the people that are the least qualified to decide. It's got the seeds of its own ruin.
True democracy, I really don't. I think after World War II, all the system changed back again. All of Europe went as a democracy. It even changed what was supposed to be a republic in America, you know, to a democracy. But this democracy, to me, is just a scam. And it's a way to go with the masses, just like communism. But communism, you don't need to have to bother going to vote. This is probably why they probably bring that in, rather than democracy, if they ever get world power.
The seeds of democracy's ruin are there in the very theory of it. So, this is why we didn't have it before. This is why we had monarchs for thousands of years. And nobody had such a daft idea as democracy and being ruled by your own people. And this is why the church were against it, quite obviously. And the next quote that I've got here is what the church hoped to gain from the fascist states. And this is what it says here. What the Catholic Church is hoping and working for as a result of the present death struggle between the fascist and democratic blocs is the re-establishment in Europe of the real state, a rigid hierarchical system wherein inferiors are subject to superiors. In this system, each individual, like a cell in a body, must humbly submit to his fate and occupy his natural place, which is allotted to him from birth, and have no desire to get away from it. This basis of social structure is not only anti-Jewish, but also anti-Protestant. It corresponds exactly to the system of the Jesuit order itself, as founded by Ignatius Loyola, the essential point of which consists in an hierarchical structure of ideas and is characteristic of all Catholic political thought. The hierarchical, as opposed to the Protestant democratic system, holds that the different races constitute the hierarchical steps in a cosmic system, which no one has the right to change or modify, either by individual or collective will. Now, he mentions there that it's the Jesuit order. But the Jesuit order took their information from the Catholic Church. So they were there to keep the doctrine of the Catholic Church as pure as possible and to try and fight against the Protestants and get them back into Catholicism. And this author is very against the Jesuits. We don't think the Jesuits are behind the conspiracy, but they're certainly not good people and they're a bad influence. But this bit here about the hierarchical structure, that's Catholic. That's the order of the cosmos. And this idea of there being gradation in the races, that's the way things are. That's why blacks have a lower IQ and live in mud huts in Africa. And we have a civilization over here in Europe. And the idea that the inferior must submit to the superior, that's natural law. And what we have today, the superior is submitting to the inferior. The inferior is placed on a pedestal through diversity quotas. So again, the church is behind this, and that's what it saw in the fascist states. It saw that they were going to overturn the democracies and put back in place the system of natural law, which is in accordance with divine law. Everything in its place, with the woman subordinate to the man, the children subordinate to the woman, the lower races not citizens of the nation. They could be guests, but they certainly couldn't be citizens. And they certainly couldn't engage in miscegenation or interbreed, because that would be destroying the race. So that the church was hoping that the nationalist states would put things back in the correct order again. And then the church could have its place instructing the spirit of the people, and the political state would have its role in the politics of things, in the civil side of things. Because again, that's what Hitler says in Mein Kampf, isn't it? About the role of the church and the role of the state. So this is what the church was hoping to gain from supporting them. You got anything else you want to say there, Dennis?
Yeah, well, I mean, we've heard lots of things about the Jesuits. I hadn't really gone too deeply into them before, because every time I heard them, Rothschilds were in charge. And I dare say they have been infiltrated at some point. But the overall facts of the Jesuits, the policy was no different, really. We spoke about this a while back, about the Nuremberg Laws. You know, the policy was no different to what Adolf Hitler back for a couple of points, maybe modernised, put into practice. They weren't allegiance to any pope. They were allegiance to the church itself. And so, you know, came across some popes. They actually got banned for 40 years at one point, but got back in again. But the sole aim was to sustain the Catholic Church against the attacks of the Jews and the Protestants in the Reformation. And they looked on England, certainly the popes looked on England as the ones with flying the flag for pseudo-Judaism, should I say, anti-Catholic feelings. Britain was that flying the flag.
Yeah, Britain was leading the opposite side of things to the nationalist way of things, Anglo-Jewry, sure. Anglo-American Jewry, and the promotion of Freemasonry and human rights. You got the French Revolution, but a lot of that was actually exported by the English Freemasons to France.
Yeah.
Britain kept out of it, but was quite happy to see this big experiment going on over in France at the time. E. Michael Jones has written about that. This Ignatius Loyola, who started the Jesuits, he was a converso Jew. So there were Jews involved in it. But this author, this L.H. Lehman, he says that the Jesuits had all these oaths and laws that they couldn't accept any Jews. So I don't know if that meant no converso Jews or no Jews altogether. And also, when we talked about them before, he said that all the intelligence agencies were based on the Jesuits and a lot of their techniques.
The way they're put together, yeah.
So they were the first guys to do this, to have this rigid hierarchical structure. And nationalism and fascism followed this as well. Well, there was a...
Adam Weiser, he wasn't a Jesuit, some people think he was, but he wasn't a Jesuit. He taught at a Jesuit school, and he learned a lot from the organisations of, you know, the likes of the Jesuits. And he put that into practice in the Illuminati.
Well, the self-discipline, and also the Jesuit schools are the top schools. They still are the top schools today. The most educated people went to Jesuit schools. It's not all bad things about these Jesuits. The next quote I've got here is about the opposition to the Catholic Church, because we're always hearing about how the National Socialists put priests in camps, and they also gassed lots of Catholic priests, and they tried to get rid of the church. And the truth is, it was just the liberal wing, the progressive wing of the church that they got rid of. And this makes it clear. Here's the quote. "There is here a case of obvious contradiction between reality and appearance. In the first place, National Socialist opposition to the Catholic Church in Germany has been confined to its liberal elements, and Catholic leadership has always opposed these more than any others. The Jesuit party has long feared the infiltration of Protestant and liberal ideas into the German Catholic mind. During the post-World War I years, when Germany was a democratic republic, many of the ordinary secular clergy and some of the religious orders became enamoured of the liberal secularising spirit. They formed the backbone of the Catholic Centre Party, which was the last bulwark against Hitler's rise to power. But this last element of liberalism in Germany was dissolved by order of Pope Pius XI as a stipulated condition of the Vatican's concordat with National Socialism. Its leader, Klausner, was assassinated in the blood purge of June 30th, 1934. The last liberal party in Italy, also headed by the exiled priest Don Sturzo, shared the same fate at the hands of the same Pope, Pius XI. It is nothing new in Catholic history that religious and social reformers from within the church should be the first to suffer its enmity." So the National Socialists were carrying out what the Catholic Church couldn't do itself, basically. Could hardly call for, the elimination of the communists that were actually within the church, but he was quite happy to allow Adolf Hitler to do it and to allow Mussolini to do it.
Yeah, this is when I did that part on the Concordat, and it mentioned that the Centre Party was told to disband. I actually said at the time that there would appear to be infiltrated. because you know the reason you close that down. And obviously that was a fact. But what I didn't realize is it came, all these left wing popes, it came with the Vatican's blessing to take them out or put them in prison.
Yeah, I mean, you got total vindication here for, you know, what you were suggesting before. The next quote I've got here is about the new social order, which is what the nationalists were hoping to bring in, or what they did bring in to quite a few countries, because this originated in Catholicism as well. A few years ago, Americans considered it incredible that the Catholic Church could be officially in favour of the fascist corporative state, much less that it could have been in any way responsible for the origin and spread of corporatism. They refused to believe that the vaunted encyclical Quadragesimo Anno of Pope Pius XI was an endorsement of the nationalist fascist objective to discredit and destroy the structure of the liberal democratic state and to set up in its stead authoritarian hierarchical regimes. Yet this encyclical embodied the whole aim of the Catholic Church for half a century before the rise of fascism, namely the total reconstruction of the then existing social order on Catholic fascist lines. The real title of this encyclical is On the Reconstruction of the Social Order, and its plan is actually the ecclesiastical counterpart of the fascist military onslaught against liberalism and democracy. Americans heard Father Coughlin preach this for 8 years, but merely shrugged their shoulders and took it for granted that his rantings were those of a crackpot and had nothing to do with the true aims and activities of the Catholic Church. It can now be seen that this plan of the Vatican, though camouflaged in terms to quiet the fears of Americans, was being carried forward officially by the Catholic Church in the United States as vigorously as in European countries. And this reminds me of when people say, oh, well, E. Michael Jones or Bishop Williamson, they're not really representative of the Catholic Church. But they are representative of the true Catholic Church and how the Catholic Church used to be. It's just because it's become corrupted now. And Father Coughlin was preaching from this encyclical from the 1900s.
Well, remember that I did a part earlier in the series on the nun who was letting rip on the people who allowed Jesus to be shown on the cross as a woman, and like a fire and brimstone kind of speech. That was, as I tried to explain, that was the Catholic Church in Europe in 1940 previous. And, you know, that's how intense it was. So when you've got a Catholic nation like Germany and others, the intensity of that religion, that nun captured it for me. And that was the reason that I actually used her. And another thing, what people don't realize as well, is that positive Christianity was not per se a German idea. That was during the Catholic Action when we talked about the Antimarian and these who were expecting the Bolsheviks to invade Europe, and certain Catholic nations were getting ready to be a bulwark against it. And this positive Christianity was adapted then by the National Socialists. And so all these people who think after the war, if Hitler had won, this positive Christianity would have been pagan and all that. No such thing. This was an idea before even the German National Socialist Party even knew of it.
Yeah, they were continuing the tradition and building upon it, something that had already been started by the Catholics, started from these encyclicals from the Pope, which was, as they say, 50 years before fascism. Well, there were two things that he mentioned there, corporatism, which I'll get into in a minute, and Father Coughlin. So we'll just hear a little bit about Father Coughlin here from Wiki. Charles Edward Coughlin was a Canadian-American Roman Catholic priest based in the United States near Detroit. Commonly known as Father Coughlin, he was one of the first political leaders to use radio to reach a mass audience. During the 1930s, an estimated 30 million listeners tuned into his weekly broadcasts. there's nothing new under the sun, is there? Making these podcasts today, just like he was doing back then. He was forced off the air in 1939. He was deplatformed because of his pro-fascist and anti-Semitic views. Initially, Coughlin was a vocal supporter of Franklin D. Roosevelt and his New Deal, but became a harsh critic of Roosevelt, accusing him of being too friendly to the bankers. In 1934, he established a political organization called the National Union for Social Justice. Its platform called for monetary reforms, nationalization of major industries and railroads, and protection of labor rights. The membership ran into the millions, but it was not that well organized locally. After hinting at attacks on Jewish bankers, Coughlin began to use his radio program to broadcast anti-Semitic commentary. In the late 1930s, he supported some of the fascist policies of Adolf Hitler, Benito Mussolini, and Emperor Hirohito of Japan. The broadcasts have been described as a variation of the fascist agenda applied to American culture. His chief topics were political and economic, rather than religious, using the slogan "Social Justice." Many American bishops, as well as the left-wing part of the Vatican, wanted him silenced. After the outbreak of World War II in Europe in 1939, the Roosevelt administration finally forced the cancellation of his radio program and forbade distribution by mail of his newspaper, Social Justice. Well, where did he get this idea from then? Because he wasn't following Adolf Hitler, he wasn't following Mussolini. He was supporting their policies, but his original ideas, again, they came from Catholicism. And this was its expression of it in America. The same expression of what was happening in Europe was Father Coughlin was the equivalent in America. Do you know much about this Father Coughlin, Dennis?
Well, all I know much is pretty much what you said, but the reason that he had to come off the air was because he threatened to cut the tax allowance to the Catholic Church. So it was told to back off.
And I think what they did with the postal thing, I think that was really illegal as well. I mean, he was massively popular.
No freedom of speech there.
Yeah, he was massively popular. And what they did, they said, the postal service is no longer going to deliver your newspaper, which wasn't entirely legal. And you think about all the pornography that you can buy in America. I mean, that was a little bit later than this. But to say, you know, the mail is not going to deliver your newspaper because we don't like your politics.
It's political, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, totally political. I do like the idea that he was making podcasts and getting deplatformed, exactly the same as what's going on today.
Exactly the same. Yeah.
Exactly the same. The next bit that was mentioned there was corporatism. I mean, you mentioned this before because I've talked about the corporations of fascism, and it's very different to the idea of the multinational corporations that we have today. I mean, this is Catholic corporatism, basically. Again, this bit comes from Wikipedia. Fascism's theory of economic corporatism involved management of sectors of the economy by government or privately controlled organizations, corporations. Each trade union or employer corporation would theoretically represent its professional concerns, especially by negotiation of labor contracts and the like. It was theorized that this method would result in harmony among the social classes. Italian fascism involved a corporatist political system in which the economy was collectively managed by employers, workers, and state officials by formal mechanisms at the national level. His supporters claimed that corporatism could better recognize or incorporate every divergent interest into the state organically, unlike majority rules democracy, which they said could marginalize specific interests. This total consideration was the inspiration for their use of the term totalitarian, described without coercion, which is connotated in the modern meaning. So the totally different meaning of the word totalitarian back then. In the 1932 Doctrine of Fascism, it says, when brought within the orbit of the state, fascism recognizes the real needs which gave rise to socialism and trade unions, giving them due weight in the guild or cooperative system in which divergent interests are coordinated and harmonized in the unity of the state. And the guild goes back to medieval times. I think we've spoken about them before in a podcast as well, Dennis.
Yeah.
The state is not simply a mechanism which limits the sphere of the supposed liberties of the individual. Neither has the fascist conception of authority anything in common with that of a police-ridden state. Far from crushing the individual, the fascist state multiplies his energies, just as in a regiment a soldier is not diminished but multiplied by the number of his fellow soldiers. The fascist state corporatism of Roman Catholic Italy influenced the governments and economies of not only other Roman Catholic majority countries, such as the governments of Engelbert Dollfuss in Austria and Antonio de Oliveira Salazar in Portugal, but also Constantine Pates and Karlis Ulmanis in non-Catholic Estonia and Latvia. Fascists in non-Catholic countries also supported Italian fascist corporatism, including Oswald Mosley of the British Union of Fascists, who commended corporatism and said that it means a nation organized as the human body, with each organ performing its individual function but working in harmony with the whole. Mosley also considered corporatism as an attack on laissez-faire economics and international finance. So this is what joined them all together as fascism, was this idea with the economy of corporatism. And it goes right back to the Catholic Church. And again, this is, whatever these organizations, these guilds were doing, it had to be for the benefit of the nation. If it was harmful to the nation, if it was to be making excess money out of the individual, and it was something that people needed every day, like energy, say, or water, then it wouldn't be allowed. And these guilds would say things have to be sold at a reasonable price. So if it's stuff that people need all the time. And if there was a shortage of something, the government, instead of the prices going up, which is the way we look at it today, we'll put the prices up and make the most profit as possible. The prices would be lowered if there was a shortage, so that everybody could still afford it. The government would step in to keep the prices low. Say if there'd been an earthquake and you needed lots of building materials. Today, the individual vendors will put the price up of the building materials and think they're going to make a killing. But that's going to hurt the interests of the nation. So under the fascist way of doing things, the building materials would all be subsidized so that people could rebuild everything quickly. The good of the nation comes before everything else. And again, that goes back to this Catholic idea. This is true socialism.
Well, I was just going to say this is where National Socialism comes into play, where the difference between Marxist Socialism, where the individual is not even cared about, doesn't mean nothing, but in National Socialism, the individual is nourished and primed because it's his labour that is valued, totally opposite to what Marxism is, just being used and thrown away.
And it's not looking at people as economic units. It's looking at that's the real value of the country is in its people, especially with National Socialism. I mean, that was the one that really valued the birth of the people. I mean, each new child that was born, they knew that they would be able to work and improve the country, so they could work out how much money that they could actually put into existence that would then be able to be paid back through the amount of work that was going to be done. Yeah. So you didn't need to add usury to the banking system. Again, totally against all Christian teaching. No, it's all right, Dennis. It's all right.
No, it just amuses me when usury crops up, because I have that argument on YouTube every now and again, and the guys will be arguing away with me, and my end comment will often be, well, just go away and pay a usury. He doesn't really realise what he's doing, but that's what he's doing.
Well, usury is it was a mortal sin.
Yeah.
And it was unlawful for over 1,000 years. It was just the Jews that were involved in it. And I think when the Jews died, I think the money went back to the king, because they weren't allowed to leave it to their descendants for quite some time. But of course, then the Jews managed to get these laws changed, and they managed to corrupt the kings and the dukes and the rest of them by getting them into debt to them.
Yeah, there's always a few Judases around, isn't there?
Well, and as it said earlier here, there's no place for the Jews in this system because they're part of another nation. They have their own nation. They can have their own fascist state somewhere. Because their way of doing things is, and this goes back to these human rights, is it's your human right to make as much profit as you can out of any other human. And that's a Jewish way of looking at things, so that wherever the Jew is, doesn't matter what country he's in, it's his right to make as much profit as he can from wherever he is. But if you think you've got a nation which is a family that's been living in one area for thousands of years, like we have, everything that we have, if you just look around the room that you're in now, everything that's in there was built by other people, part of your nation. And things like televisions and computers, it was all built by knowledge and of the people that came before us. So it's not ours to sell. It's not ours to give away. It's not ours to say to the Japanese and the Chinese and sell it to them. It's stuff that our people have made in the past. And if we try to make as much profit as we can from our fellow man, we'd just end up being very rich and our fellow man would end up being very poor. And if you're a Jew, it doesn't matter because that's another different people. But for us, that's going to hurt us because that's our family that are poor. And we've got some members of our family that are rich and other members of our family that are starving and out on the street because of this idea of making as much profit as you can from your fellow man.
Yeah, well, I've always felt with capitalism, the big downfall for me is obviously profit, it rises above everything. And that saying, whereas he would sell his grandmother, if put in that position, he would sell his grandmother if it meant profit, which is not a moral type of ideology in my eyes.
I think it's in Proverbs. There's a verse in Proverbs. It says, cast your bread upon the waters, for it will come back to you. And what I think what that means is if you're in a closed system, like say you're within an ethnically homogenous nation, and you pass out your money to somebody that's poor there on the street or whatever, they spend it on their food or whatever they spend it on. That money doesn't disappear. It stays circulating. And eventually it will come back to you if it's in a small system. If you've got somebody else in there, if you've got a foreigner in there, then any money that they get is going to be siphoned off out of the system. So if you have a multicultural system and you cast your bread upon the waters, it doesn't enrich that system. It gets taken out from it. Your people collectively aren't going to get more wealthy by you investing money into it. It's just going to get taken away from it. If you have an ethnically homogenous group, it's going to increase the wealth because wherever it goes, people are going to invest it and build more with it.
Problem is, where we're at today, say for instance, the football clubs, I don't think there's any football club in the Premiership owned by some from England. I think they're all Arabs. They're, you know, from Russian Jews. And I don't think, you know, I mean, we've got our own stadiums. I think Wembley's owned by a Pakistani.
A lot of stuff is owned, has got foreign ownership. Even our power companies, our electric companies, has got foreign ownership. So the money that we're paying out goes into foreign pockets and it doesn't get invested again by our people. I mean, if you think you've got somebody that's really bright and they're intelligent, but they haven't got any money, somebody lends them some money or gives them some money, they start up a business, they improve the wealth, they create new things for the people in that society, and the whole society gets richer, and then there'll be somebody else that can be helped out. And if you've got this idea of making the most profit as you can out of your fellow man, and you've also got foreigners there, that wealth isn't going to make the whole area richer. It's just going to make individuals richer. And if those individuals happen to be Jews, it's going to make the whole Jewish community richer. And the Gentile community is just going to get poorer and poorer. There was another thing that I forgot to mention just when I was saying earlier about the Germans when they had kids. They knew that the larger the German nation got, the wealthier it would get. Because the more Germans they've got, the more white people they've got, the more innovation, the more creation there will be, they'll create fascinating things. At the other end of the scale, if you've got Negroes, the more Negroes you've got, the poorer your country is going to get. They don't improve the country. They just drain the resources of the country. And we see the proof of that in all the countries in Africa that are overpopulated. And we see the opposite. We've
seen in Europe.
Yeah, and we're now seeing that in Europe now. I think it's called Malthusian dynamics. Malthusian, and they use this to say that when we have soon we're going to have a problem with too many people in the world, and there won't be enough resources. Everybody needs to cut back and use contraception and abortion, and only have one child. And that was based on this Malthusian idea that the more people you have, the poorer you're actually going to get. That doesn't work out for white people. The more white people you've got, the more chances you have of geniuses being born that are going to create amazing things, and they're going to improve the wealth. But the more Negroes you have born, the more of a drain on resources that's going to be. So the opposite end of the scale.
I was going to say, what I don't like about our education system is that my way of thinking is that people are going to be either artistic, or they're going to be, you know, more useful with their hands or mechanically. But at some stage, a kid can be recognised, a child, for its natural talent. Now, I felt at the time I was at school that if I was good at such a thing, I should be concentrating more on that than anything else. But what they do is they spread all these lessons where you just learn a bit of this, a bit of that, a bit of this, and you end up leaving school, you don't know nothing. When every child has a natural talent, if you like, for being either creative or constructive.
They don't want that. Do you know what they're doing in universities at the moment? You know, the group of people that get the highest exam results, the highest percentage of exam results, are the same group of people that are now the least likely to go to university. And the group of people that always get the lowest exam results, 30 points lower than the other group, they're trying to get as many of them to go to university as possible. Negroes get an average, only 50% of them get top marks, whereas white people, 80% of them get top marks. And white people, there was only an increase of 1% on the amount of whites going to university now, and it's about 25% is all it is. And the non-whites, it's all above 50% are now going to university. And they're driving to get more of them to go there, even though they are the least successful.
That's the qualifier mark, yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely pointless, absolutely ridiculous. You want to invest in the very best people that are going to return that investment, and they're not. They're doing the opposite. I mean, just to say, you know, they are encouraging the people least likely to succeed and investing all their resources in the people least likely to succeed and turning away the people most likely to succeed. I mean, that just shows you, doesn't it? We must have a foreign power occupying us to be doing that to us.
Yeah, because that's something the Soviets would do. Or more brutally, they just go in and just kill all the intelligentsia. Whereas this way, we don't even get the chance of being intelligent.
Well, that's just it. I mean, you say, well, some of these Soviet ideas, they were really nonsensical, but how more nonsensical can you get than what they're doing? And they put it in fluffy language. Well, we want to encourage the ethnic minorities to do well. But that's not what they're doing.
We're in a bit thin, that one.
It is. Getting back to these quotes, the next one is on the actual bishops themselves in the fascist countries. The Roman Catholic bishops of Italy, Spain and Germany, however, supported the rise of fascism and National Socialism in their respective countries. In their pastoral letter from Fulda on August 30th, 1936, the Catholic hierarchy of Germany solemnly declared to their people, "There is no need to speak at length of the task which our people and our country are called upon to undertake. May our Führer, with the help of God, succeed in this extraordinarily difficult work. What we desire is that belief in God, as taught by Christianity, will not be overcome, but that it will be universally recognized that this faith constitutes the only sure foundation upon which can be built the powerful and victorious bulwark destined to hold back the forces of Bolshevism." So that was the point of it. Christianity is the only thing that could defeat communism.
I hate to say I was right, but
and that's,
I was right.
So the Catholic hierarchy, they weren't speaking against Adolf Hitler. They were praying for
his birthday.
Yeah, we've got loads more from them as well. This is another one from Germany. all doubts as to the wholehearted support of Hitler's program from the beginning by the Catholic hierarchy in Germany are cleared up by perusal of the discourses and writings of Bishop Aloysius Hudal, rector of the Collegio Teutonico in Rome and one of the closet consultors of the Holy See on German and Austrian affairs. In his book, The Fundamentals of National Socialism, he repeats the contents of many of his allocutions to the German colony in Rome. The following is a sample. Let us see, for example, how interesting are some of the objectives of the National Socialist program. Popular unity, as opposed to everything that can disrupt. Language as the nation's spiritual bond. Consciousness of Germany's historical destiny. The sentiment of race consciousness. The attempt to solve the Jewish question. Assurance of pure German breeding. Destruction of political parties. Culture of the family. And the ideal of the large family considered as a matter of honour and national pride. The militarization of the nation, a new system of instruction and education, the corporative idea, the aristocratic principle of government by a leader. Above all, the German people are indebted to this spiritual movement for the slow destruction of the ideology of the rights of man, as the human rights, upon which the edifice of Weimar was founded, as well as for destruction of faith in formal juridical constitutions, of the dialects of parliamentary procedures, and of democracy. So he really wasn't pulling any punches there. I knew that's that's full on, isn't it? The National Socialist program.
Yeah, I mean, that brings you to the moral standards that match each other as well. I mean, when I went into this, like Berlin, went in for a reason. I called it Babylon for a reason. Which was exactly what the Catholic Church would have called it, because of discussing things what went on there. But Hitler sorted that out, and that was pure Christianity or Catholicism.
It's interesting that they mentioned there that language is the unifier, because if you look back in history and you look at the Orthodox Church, that was all built around language. And rather than, you know, sort of having DNA tests or doing genetics, they used to say, well, if you speak that language, you're part of that nation. So they were saying that people that have Germanic languages, they are all part of this same race, this same nation. And that's how the church used to be. That's why you have a Greek Orthodox Church, a Russian Orthodox Church. And it was people that spoke Russian or people that spoke Greek. And what you've got here is the larger Germanic Reich, the larger Germanic peoples united by the language that they spoke, which is a Christian idea. That's how people should be split up into people groups is by the language that they spoke. And it's only now in modern times that you can't really do that because you've got mestizos that all speak Spanish in South America.
Yeah.
You know, and now over here in Britain, you've got Negroes that are speaking English. But a century or so ago, you could separate people by the language and say, well, that's what people they are. They understand one another. They understand the language.
Well, I just wanted to mention the Spanish Revolution. I remember, we were never taught anything about it at school. And very few people online who commented with me knew little about it. And that really emphasized World War II. Because what happened, Mussolini and Hitler formed together to defeat communism in Spain, help Franco out, and 9 months later, the big one actually started, probably less than that. And that's probably why it's not been taught and will never be taught, because what went on there was a mini holy war, and the big one was yet to come.
And this was written in 1944. So the first copy was in 1942 and then he amended it for 1944. So he's writing at the actual time, because I don't know whether that book, The Fundamentals of National Socialism, whether that is still available, but that was what was written to the Germans that were in Rome, basically at the Collegio Teutonico, listing all the, similarities between National Socialism, what the National Socialists wanted, and what the Church wanted. And that makes it clear that the Church wanted these things as well. And we probably haven't got enough time to finish the next bit. We can get into some of it next week. But it's the Church and National Socialism have identical interests. In order to prove the identity of interests between Catholicism and National Socialism, Bishop Hudal quotes from the Catholic German historian Joseph Lortz of Münster, who in his work History of the Churches shows that Catholicism and National Socialism agree on the following points. Number one, both are mortal enemies of Bolshevism, liberalism, and relativism. That is to say, of the three deadly maladies from which our age is suffering and which fiercely attack the work of the Church, the essential ideas of National Socialism, together with the principle of liberty bound to authority, correspond exactly to the ideas that Popes Gregory and Pius IX endeavoured to impose upon the 19th century in the face of a world which called itself progressive and which received their teachings with sarcastic smiles. To this is added their common fight against Freemasonry. So that traces it right back to the 19th century and shows that this was a continuing tradition of the Church, that the National Socialists were just continuing, fighting against liberalism and relativism, and it had grown to become Bolshevism. And it lists these popes there, speaking against
them. Hitler, protector of Christianity and of Europe.
Protector of the Church, wasn't he? Bringing back the crown jewels to Nuremberg, right, back to their rightful place. Number two, their common fight against the godless movement, against public immorality, against the stupid doctrine of equality, which is destructive of life. Their fight for a rational and fertile structure of human society as desired by God, and for the corporative structure of the state as proposed by Popes Leo XIII and Pius XI from the Quadragesima Anno that I mentioned earlier. Their common fight against a mode of life that is unnatural and deprived of all healthy traditions as encountered in great modern cities and workmen's localities. So there's the fight against atheism. And this is and that's a Catholic German historian that he's quoting from. Number three.
By the 1950s, the UN said, for sure, that we all come from monkeys, I think.
Darwin, when was it that Darwin said that? It was earlier, wasn't it?
Yeah, but I think the UN came to an agreement that was now, true. Wasn't a theory.
And they were godless atheism, godless communism. I mean, that was a major thing that they were fighting against. But I guess the evolution hadn't really taken hold at this time.
No, they were just sowing the seeds.
Number three, by its principle of authority and government by a leader, a principle upon which all national life rests, National Socialism combines the German and the Catholic attitude towards human life. So democracy isn't Christian. There's nothing Christian about democracy. So, monarchy is Christian, but in the absence of monarchs, then fascism or National Socialism is the way to go. Have a Führer who makes decisions and who can be held accountable. Nobody can be held accountable for the cock-ups that the government makes.
Took a dive in that place, don't they?
Yeah, and 4 years later, they're gone. And the next lot come in and they say, it was the previous government that made all these mistakes. Nobody's
on and on it goes with every generation.
Yeah, nobody's accountable and nobody can make any decisions that actually of any importance. Number four, most important of all, National Socialism is a confession of faith, opposing as it does unbelief and destructive doubt. It has convinced all classes of society that the outlook of the believer is not, as liberalism has taught, an attitude of inferiority, but one that carries man towards the total accomplishment of his destiny. And although the Catholic Church should never identify itself with any movement, it cannot afford to miss the opportunity of gratefully accepting the help of this powerful ally in the fight which she is carrying on against atheistic rationalism. And this is what I'm saying. This white supremacy is bad. We should be telling our people that we are the best people, because then they will be the best people. If you tell us that we're inferior and we enslave the blacks and we're no better than blacks, people aren't, they've got no incentive to actually be any better, got no incentive to be the best person that they can possibly be. If you tell white people that they had fantastic ancestors, they're capable of doing all these wonderful things, and they had these great morals, and they had self-discipline and self-sacrifice, and they were able to work on building projects for 100 years and do things for their kids, and just how wonderful they were, then,
yeah,
you know,
sure.
Yeah, then the next generation are going to say, yeah, I can do that as well. And they will try to be the best people that they can be.
They'll probably go on and better at some stage.
Yeah. Yeah, but we're taught that we're inferior. We're not as good as the blacks.
The one I didn't like was the fact that you used to teach at school, it's not about winning, it's about taking power.
Why say that to people that, you know, do have the capability of winning?
Exactly.
That's the thing. We should be inspiring our children, not telling them that they're.
Well, they're just letting them all out, aren't they? That's why nobody's different than any other. That's the theory behind it.
Well, yeah, telling everybody's all equal. No, we're not. Some of us are much better than others, and we should be encouraging them to be better than others. It's a university thing.
I mean, I'll admit that, you know, there'll be some guys who know a lot more than I do. We can't all be the same.
And we need to encourage the ones that have that potential, not to look them over for people that don't have any potential like they are in the universities. Anyway, I guess we'll get into some more of that next week, I think, Dennis. So
yeah, it's fascinating.
Yeah, it's great. Really, a good find. Thank you very much for coming on today, Dennis.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We'll be back next Friday with more Truth Without Radio for you, and we do hope you have a great weekend.